You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of December 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Are you truly incapable of shame? Is there literally nothing that can shame you? Is there no act of barbarism against civilians, no execution of a child that gets under your skin, that just creeps you out a little bit? Is there nothing you will not lie about or justify?
Outrage over Aleppo. Would a bit more of this sort of talk 2 or 3 years ago have made any difference? My guests Kathleen Burke and Tim Marshall will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Beijing's attempt to figure out Donald Trump as the president-elect's gifts to Moscow continue, the US, which seems to be having quite a week for belatedly noticing things, restricting arms sale to Saudi Arabia due to their indiscriminate use in Yemen, and France extends its state of emergency again. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Tim Marshall, editor of thewhatandthewhy.com, former diplomatic editor of Sky News. Welcome both. And we will start in Aleppo, where in the last few hours, the latest ceasefire appears to have broken down as Syrian government forces close in on the last remaining pockets of rebel resistance. A deal had been brokered by Russia and Turkey to evacuate fighters and civilians from rebel-held areas, but latest reports suggest that fighting has well and truly resumed, up to and including airstrikes. Kathleen, first of all, are we watching the beginning of the end of the Syrian civil war?
Or the end of the beginning? What we're watching, what I found quite interesting was showing just how little influence the Russians had over the Iranians, or the Iranian militia would not have stopped the refugees contravening the Russian and Turkish agreement. They didn't take a blind bit of notice, and so therefore it's not an alliance in the tightly knit sort, shall we say. It's an alliance of convenience, and it was not convenient for the Iranians. Is this the end of the beginning of the end? Depends. I don't think so. I mean, what it's going to do is drive the militants of whatever stripe out of the cities, but there's an awful lot of rural area and an awful lot of pockets which are going to continue fighting. The question is, how much will bombing by the Russian Air Force actually do to curtail this? The omens are not good if you look at what the Americans did for years and how little it was successful.
Tim, you have reported from Syria within the last couple of years from Damascus and other places. When we're watching this story unfold, how possible is it to be actually certain of what is going on? As somebody who has myself been trying to take an interest, it obviously has become a, there's orchestrated propaganda on both sides. If you want to believe that this is in fact the recapturing of a city by the legitimate forces of a legitimate government from terrorists, you can believe that. Or if you want to believe that this is the sort of last dogged stand of pro-democracy freedom fighters against a tyrannical oppressor, you can believe that. How do you know what's actually going on at this point?
You glimpse it. You glimpse the truth. And you start from the premise that both sides are lying, because in war, all sides lie.
Yeah.
So you can start from that premise and then try and work your way forward. I mean, I was pretty confident from the very beginning. This whole country is not rising up against Assad. There are huge amounts of people that support the guy and know what might happen. To answer your first question to Karen, I think we are at the beginning of the end, but if that's true, let's put it into three thirds. The first was the beginning, the second was the middle, and if we are now entering the end phase, which I think we are, but I think that's, we had 3 years of that, 3 years of the middle. I think we may still have 3 years of the end, but I think we are at the beginning of the end, because the spine of Syria is the motorway that connects Aleppo, Hama, Homs, Damascus, and then down to the southern border. And about 80% of the population lives there, and they've got nearly the whole lot now. So I think it is the beginning of the end. But I also completely agree with Karen about the idea that the Iranians. It's the Iranian militia that appear to have put the kibosh on the ceasefire, and so the people can't get out. And what that tells you is they've got the most people on the ground. There are thousands of young men desperately trying to volunteer to die in Syria that are from Iran. They've got more people on the ground, and because we're approaching the end of the beginning, that is why you're seeing the split between the Russians, Assad, and the Iranians, because they're all now trying to shape the end in their own way.
Kathleen, we heard at the top of the show Samantha Power, the US ambassador to the UN, making a fairly impassioned peroration in the direction of the Russian delegation. The sanctimonious posturing by the United States is a bit much at this point, is it not?
Well, it depends on what you mean by at this point. I presume the Russian ambassador, by saying you did, you know, a plague on your house because you did the same thing, was not referring to Syria particularly. It was referring to the past 50 years of history, I think. The U.S. has always had a long line of self-righteousness. So I think I've said in this program before, it inherited it from the British Empire.
How dare you?
Easy. But the U.S. has knowingly abdicated influence and power in the Middle East. The game was not worth the candle, as far as one can tell, that President Obama thought. Therefore, it should not be surprising to the Americans if all they can do is stand in the UN and saying how appalling it's been. Well, of course it's been appalling, and it didn't hurt anything for Samantha Powers to say that. But you notice this whole episode, the Americans aren't involved. No one took a notice of what the Americans might want because they do not
It's not an existential matter for them. Same as Libya wasn't. American oil don't get oil from Libya. It's off the coast of Europe. They didn't care. They don't particularly care. In fact, they care even less strategically. Although you can make an argument about why they should care, and I would actually because of Russian influence, but I'll try to come back to that briefly. But yeah, it was pretty nauseating listening to Samantha Powers. I mean, what she said was true. It is awful what the Russian and the Iranians and the Assad regime has done. Nevertheless, where were you 3 years ago with your big red lines? You do this, I'll whack you with a stick. And then they didn't, and just gave a green light for them to behave in any way they want. That's a little bit nauseating. The reason why I think they should care is that when it's all coming home to roost now, the basis, I believe, is that Russia got involved in Syria because of Ukrainian sanctions. They are now going to go to the Trump guys and say, right, you want us to sort this Syrian thing out for you? Now that we've planted ourselves in the Middle East, the price is the sanctions against us on Ukraine. Let's do a quid pro quo, and off we go. And I don't think that's healthy for the future.
I was going to ask, in fact, just what you thought would be the case when Trump came into. I mean, you're a specialist on this area. And
I thought he was a generalist, but go on. But thank you. Thank you, Kathleen.
I withdraw my compliment then. When you think of who President-elect Trump is appointing, not only to a man who, as his national security advisor, who thinks the Islamist threat is the greatest threat in the world, on the other hand, a Secretary of State who thinks we have to work with the Russians, on the third hand, you see what I mean. So what do you think?
The businessman sees that the better deal is to screw China. Consequently, you flip the Nixon doctrine on its head, which we'll probably come back to in the next issue. And I also believe that Trump is giving strong signals that he believes in spheres of influence.
So you think he's going to allow Russia to say, this is our sphere of influence?
Yes. And now, look, America, as you know, has always had and recognized spheres of influence.
It's called the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah, they've never openly admitted it. The Monroe Doctrine is based on, this is our backyard, get out of it, otherwise we'll kill you. But nobody else can have a sphere of influence. But Trump is the first U.S. president I've ever seen who actually appears to be suggesting this is your sphere of influence, this is ours, now let's do a deal.
Well, that does lead us seamlessly into our next item, which is the ongoing unveiling of President-elect Donald Trump's administration. This is continuing to prompt ever more exuberant flinging of furry hats into the air in Moscow, and increasingly unamused expressions, both facial and rhetorical, from Beijing. The nomination of ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State seems an especially extravagant present to Vladimir Putin, who already thinks well enough of him to have awarded him the Russian Order of Friendship. Other recipients, I was delighted to discover earlier, include George Blake. But how will this be playing in Beijing? Kathleen, Trump, he is either freezing China out or he wants China to worry that it's being frozen out. What does Trump actually want? Do we know that yet?
You mean besides and trade, as he added in his what we might swap for Taiwan? That's surely not a marker. He wants what he wants, which is for the Chinese to recognize that the U.S. is still a power there, and they can't do what they want to do without consideration. They want the Chinese to make some concessions, whatever they might be, on trade relationships, very important to Trump. And he wants to establish himself as a strong man, that leaders can no longer walk over a patsy, I think is the idea, is what he thinks. And therefore, they have to know they've got a strong America that is likely to react forcefully if American plans are not given taken account of. I mean, you look at the Middle East, U.S. of no consequence. Now, it may be that he doesn't care about that. He may well, but he doubtless will have noticed that they don't care. And he probably has in mind as well, even if it's not been fully articulated, that people are going to care where the Americans are and what they want, because they don't know what will happen if they don't. Nothing may happen, but...
Tim, every so often when discussing the looming Trump presidency, just for fun, I like to attempt optimism. Is there any reason at all to think that his fairly ostentatious pivot to Moscow might not be a bad thing? Is it naive to wonder if it would be better if the United States and Russia get on well than if the United States and Russia don't?
Yes and no.
Ukraine,
yes and no. By which I mean, yes, it's a bad thing, and... sorry, no, it is a bad thing, and yes, that is naive.
Okay.
But let me answer. first of all, it's good for journalism. Trump has got a mad dog and now a T-Rex. I mean, you know, how good is that for journalism? this guy Tillerson is known as T-Rex. On the China and the Taiwan call, you probably know Nixon, the deal was, and it was an easy deal to make, they were terrified of the USSR. The USSR and China were virtually enemies at the time. So Nixon goes to China and the deal is we'll cozy up with each other. What's the price? The price is I will de-recognize Taiwan. The Americans have never actually recognized that Beijing has sovereignty over Taiwan, but they just haven't. They unrecognized Taiwan. That was a very,
this,
very...
This was at a time when, of course, Taiwan also claimed sovereignty over China.
Well, still does, technically.
Technically.
So, and then that was a very, very easy price for both countries to pay, and they got much, much closer, and that split the Russian forces, because at the time it was the Russian forces that were seen as a threat. Now, you fast forward, and not a single American president has spoken to a Taiwanese leader directly since, and now that's going to change, because it has flipped the decades that have passed. Now, the incoming president sees the greatest threat is China, not Russia. And so consequently, he may be trying to flip it again by basically walking around the car, kicking its tires and going, oh, not sure, I mean, look, I think he's bringing a business model to diplomacy. We've yet to see if that can work, because they are different things. But he's bringing the business model to diplomacy, saying, I'm not sure I like this deal. He's absolutely put the wind up the Chinese. They have no idea what he's going to do. If it does come to a trade war, the Americans will win it hands down, but they'll both lose.
Well, he's also put the wind up the Taiwanese, because they don't know. They think the collateral damage on them could be appalling, and they also think, well, if he's talking like that, we might be the price. So I think it undercuts Taiwanese confidence as well. I don't know how much that's been in the paper, but it seems quite obvious.
Well, why, in that case, why did they
engineer the phone call over weeks of negotiations.
That's if we believe that that's how it happened.
Absolutely. Rabus has got, the chief of staff has got a lot of contacts in Taiwan. There's another part of the transition team that is actually a Taiwan specialist. And Bob Dole, who's now close to Trump, is very close to the Taiwanese government. They all went for this for weeks and weeks in advance. And the new Taiwanese government is not the old one, which was cozying up to China. It's the new one. I think this is absolutely a pivot between the Taiwanese and the Trump administration to put the squeeze on China for, as Catherine pointed out, the trade deals, because he's going to try and renegotiate it and bring jobs back to the United States. I have no idea if any of this is going to work, but I think just read the art of the deal, which he didn't write, but, you know, it's his thoughts on paper. And he's bringing the art of the deal to international diplomacy, and it's a first, and it's fascinating, and it makes you a little bit nervous.
Kathleen, I asked Tim a willfully naive question, so I'll ask you one as well. At that time when that process that Tim was recalling was occurring, Nixon sort of opening up of China and a slight exiling into the cold of the Republic of China versus the People's Republic, Taiwan and China, they're both military dictatorships. You just basically, you're picking one over the other. But Taiwan is now... in reality, if not in law, a functional first world democracy. Is it a bad thing if a president-elect of the United States decides to speak to its president at the risk of annoying a fairly unpleasant tyranny?
In an ideal world. There's another thing that's different from 72, which is in 72, one reason Nixon could do it safely was that the Sino-Soviet split... Soviet Union and China were enemies. They'd actually fought over the Yalu River. And now, of course, they are actually rather closer. And one thing that worries Putin is, will the cozying up to China mean that China will be further away from Russia? So there's another element in there one has to consider. Taiwan may be the sacrifice. Probably not. But they must certainly, that if they think they might, that must make them more accommodating to what the United States wants them to do.
Just a final thought on this one, Tim. There's been a lot of talk about I think Kathleen mentioned it herself, the strongman image of Donald Trump as he sees himself and also as he sees it reflected in Vladimir Putin. This is a description you could also apply to Xi Jinping. Is it impossible that Trump might actually decide that Xi Jinping's his sort of chap after all?
Yes, as long as he does the trade deal with terms favourable to the United States. And as I said, I personally believe in a trade war. America will smash China, but they'll both end up losing. So I was in Beijing last month, and it was startling to see the cult of personality that has arisen around Xi. If you want to buy a mug, you can either get a mug of Mao or a mug of Xi, not a single president in between. They've all been written out. This is the new guy. He is selling himself as a tough guy. And the three of them, I mean, it's fascinating. It's a fascinating time. As I said, Trump is stirring the pot and the whole thing's up in the air. And these are new times. I don't think they're going to sell out Taiwan. Just today, the Taiwanese, the Japanese, and the Americans had yet another security in the South China Sea meeting. America's policy rests on their alliances in that part of the world. They can't sell them out yet.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Kathleen Burke and Tim Marshall. Coming up next, the US limits arms sales to Saudi Arabia over concerns about their use in Yemen. Why now?
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Mullister. With me are Kathleen Burke and Tim Marshall. Now, it seems to have taken the US a bizarre amount of time to notice, but the vast quantities of weapons it sells to Saudi Arabia are not exclusively for display purposes. A great many have been used to devastating effect in Yemen, where the Saudis are leading a coalition supporting the country's elected government against the Iran-backed Houthi rebels who have seized much of Yemen. And the Saudis are not always being fussy about what they're dropping or on whom. The US has now announced that it will limit shipments of certain weapons. Tim, among those certain weapons it will limit the shipments of are precision-guided weapons.
PGMs.
That seems counterproductive if their issue is that the Saudis aren't necessarily being terrifically precise about what they're bombing.
Oh, no, they may be precise about what they're bombing, and they may be using precision missiles to precisionally bomb. But it's just that one in every four airstrikes using precision missiles have gone into civilian areas, not military areas. So it's not that they're necessarily missing their targets with the PGMs. It's that they may be targeting civilians, or at least not taking enough care not to fire into civilian areas when they're trying to hit military targets. You know, you're supposed to... Your rules of engagement are supposed to say, no, you know, I can see there's too many civilians, I'm not going to fire that missile. You know, they've hit the same market 24 times, the Saudis. The same market. Now, almost certainly, there will be some military activity in that market, but they've gone back time and time again, and they've hit the market. And eventually, the Americans have said, you know what, to Raytheon, because it's Raytheon that makes these missiles, we're going to have to suspend this. I'm equally interested in the knock-on effect now to the British, because the British have got military personnel in the Saudi headquarters that advise them on international law. They don't press buttons and they don't say, yes, you will or you won't target that, but they do give them international legal advice on the targets of choice. And I think now the Americans have done this, someone's going to put some pressure onto our parliament and say, what about us?
Kathleen, do we understand what has brought on this sudden seizure of conscience from the United States?
I did wonder about that very question, and the only answer I can come up with is that it's a last attempt by Obama to leave some sort of reasonable legacy. The point is, it can be overruled as soon as Trump comes in. You know, that Raytheon will be
it's
told.
It's a bit of a gesture, isn't it, really?
Well, yes, it is. Yeah. A question of whether you think politics of gesture have any lasting proof other than making him feel good.
I think gestures do matter, but...
I mean, the British thing is interesting because I didn't know. I had understood they also discussed targeting, but...
No, they discussed targeting, but our advice is that on this targeting, if you hit that, you are not committing a war crime.
But it's okay to hit a market 24 times.
I don't know.
As long as there's no.
I don't know what the advice was on that market. But of course, the Saudis are a sovereign state, and if they decide they're going to hit the market, even if the British tell them, but this is the things that we need to know about. You know, for example, how many times have the Saudis said, "Thank you for your advice. We disagree." That's the sort of stuff we need to know now.
And thank you for your advice. We'll do what we can.
Nicely put. Yeah. And we've sold them $3.5 billion worth of weapons since the Yemen conflict began.
But do we, Tim, do we get the impression that by the Saudis' own judgment, from the Saudis' own perspective, leaving aside any rights or wrongs, are they getting anywhere in Yemen?
They've halted the Houthi advance, which they regard as a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The Houthis are a Shia offshoot that are closer to Iran. I mean, I'm not sure it's entirely a proxy war, but they have halted that. They have driven them out of the capital. They are now only strong in their own region. So in that respect, they have held the line. The cross-border shelling from the Houthis into Saudi Arabia itself is vastly diminished. But I will admit, I thought when they got involved a year and a half ago that they would sort it. And I'm surprised at how little actual advances they've made. They've simply held the line.
What you'll have to do at some future program, one I was on some time ago when the new defense minister, age 26, came into power, the idea of how successful he would be, and especially with his inauguration of the war in Saudi Arabia. It would be nice to know what his position is now after the somewhat unsuccessful attempt at shock and awe.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we shall look at France, where the National Assembly has voted overwhelmingly to extend for the fifth time the state of emergency imposed following Islamic State's attacks on Paris in November 2015. This latest reiteration will see the special measures last until July 15th, going beyond the presidential election scheduled for April and May and the parliamentary elections in June. Tim, are we seeing here a lesson in how much easier it is to impose these things than withdraw them?
Very much so. And it's now apparently going to be the longest state of emergency since the French-Algerian War of Independence, which is, you know, really shows us the times that we're in. And it also shows us, because I sometimes say to think to myself, you know, if I could speak to a suicide bomber, preferably before he or she committed the act,
there would appear to be little point in speaking to them subsequently.
In heaven, if they take you.
Exactly. That depends on your belief system, but let's not go there. You know, you think about this incident, that incident, that incident, countless down for the past 10 years. What have you achieved? And they've actually achieved very, very little, except they know about destruction. They don't know about building. But here's something they have achieved. Through these acts, they have caused France to have a state of emergency for the longest period since the Algerian War. And that, in their eyes, is a victory, because they are changing our culture, they are changing our laws, they are pushing us into what we would have regarded previously as extreme measures. And the more extreme we become, the greater the splits there are in our societies, and the more they are then able to enter those gaps.
Who's they?
The jihadist Islamist worldview, which takes on many forms, whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's ISIS or Jabhat al-Nusra, they are very, very clever. They read us better than we read them. They know if they can divide us by killing us and causing us to be more extreme, they then enter those gaps. They split our societies. They want hundreds of thousands of poor, radicalized Muslims all over Europe. They want lots of Muslims in Europe to be suffering. They don't want them to have a good time. They don't want them to have freedom of religion. They don't want any of that. They are working day and night to make sure that the Muslims of Europe get as hellish time as possible in order to influence them, because they want to take over the countries eventually.
Kathleen, why doesn't there appear to be more objection to this for all the reasons Tim mentioned? This passed the National Assembly 288 votes to 32. MPs presumably believe in their reflecting the will of their constituents. Is it that people would rather feel like they're safe than at liberty?
Bataclan, Nice?
Yeah.
Because hundreds got killed. Yes, the idea is somehow if we were just a little bit more careful or a little bit more energized and watching, they'd be better if they had a little bit more IT knowledge of what the what they were doing on the internet. Yes, people on the whole, time after time, history proves to us, people will usually choose safety over freedom. Think of Turkey right now.
And bread over democracy or whatever,
Even if it's illusory. I mean, Tim, do you get the impression, I mean, you know, terrorist attacks have happened since the state of emergency was imposed. Does it actually make it any more or less difficult for somebody to mount one?
Well, let me answer the first question about, is it illusory? And the answer to that is it doesn't matter whether it's illusory or not. People will believe in it. The Maginot Line? People believed the Maginot Line. I mean, the Germans went round it. People believed in the Great Wall of China. The Mongols got someone to open the gates and came straight through it. It does make people feel more secure. You know, after a terrorist attack in a Western country, for the next 2 or 3 days, you see loads of policemen and women at train stations. What difference is that going to make? All right, I'll go to the bus station and blow that up instead. But it makes you feel that the state is doing something. And these gestures make the society feel stronger and more safe. And so they've got a state. I would say also, actually, there are elements of the state of emergency which sound rather unpleasant, but in fact do allow them to go and kick doors down. They are kicking doors down. They are breaking up terrorist plots left, right and centre. The problem is that pour encourager les autres and to round up the usual suspects, you are also, some innocent people are getting dragged into this, further fueling the propaganda that says, you look how they're treating us. I mean, it's such a delicate issue, and it's so, so hard to get it right.
Kathleen, final very brief thought. With elections coming up, shouldn't the French be more worried about the Russians?
You mean financing Marie Le Pen?
Or doing whatever it is that Russia's been doing.
Well, they're opening a new propaganda channel in France. Sorry.
Well, no, yes. Russia is a long way away, and most people are going to think jihadis are a lot closer to us.
Kathleen Burke and Tim Marshall, thank you both very much for joining us. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Naomi Joseph. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. There's music next at 1900 hours. Daniel Giacopelli is in with the entrepreneurs, and I'll have more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Mullett. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.